Okay, why don't you go ahead, sir? We took a break, and where we left off, you had come back from your TDY over in Thailand, and you're back at MacDill. So what was your reaction, basically, getting back? This is early on in the war, for the most part, in late 1965. Did people ask you about Vietnam, what was happening there, things like that, or was it more of a hush-hush topic?
No, actually, they did. When we got back, of course, everyone wanted to leave and just wanted to be with their families. So
Right. We,
at least everyone was trying to get 30 days, which they'd ask for, but nobody ended up getting that. There was always something coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And matter of fact, in my case, I had to go up to the Pentagon with another guy from MacDill. And I think there was five 105 pilots.
Mm-hmm.
And we were supposed to give this briefing. Build a briefing on what was happening and some of the good stuff, and they said, don't worry, tell everything.
Mm-hmm.
And we did.
Right.
They just literally threw us out of there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we never, the highest the briefing went was a full colonel, and he said, that's it, we're never going to get this through anybody.
Why?
Well, it was too, we said all the stuff they didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
But it was basically, we all said the things that were wrong with our weapons, the guns, the not having a gun, the engine smoked, the missiles didn't work, you know, all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, and the 105 guy said the same thing. This is, you're using this the wrong way, this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started getting into the briefings and why they were having us at the same time and the JCS schedule and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it just got worse and worse. So, finally they just said, we can't do this. And we came back, and frankly, nobody really cared too much, and neither did our commanders.
What did you think about that?
I didn't think too much of it at the time. I just kind of thought, well, that's kind of standard.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't real interested in that business at that time anyway. I just wanted to meet my family over again and see my kids and
mm-hmm.
fix things that were broken and all that kind of junk you do when you're gone for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ended up getting back, and right after we got there, we cleaned up squadron and opened the thing up that had been basically closed, and we found stuff from the guys that were shot down and dead and all that stuff, and that was kind of sad. And
mm-hmm.
everyone got medals and all that kind of stuff and
mm-hmm.
and little ceremonies, and we'd find things here and there. And finally, it was, maybe a month or so, 6 weeks, and then it just kind of, we all got busy again.
Mm-hmm.
And I was asked if I would go and teach in the academic section because we were starting these replacement training unit program there.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted guys that had been there to have a little more credibility as far as teaching. So I went down to teach, and the other good deal was that they promised that they'd put me in for the fire weapons school and I'd get a full colonel's OER, my evaluation report, and signed by him and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what rank were you at this point?
I was a captain.
Okay.
And so I went down to the academic section, and we looked over the curricula and the syllabus that they'd invented for us, and we decided we'd change it because it really wasn't current.
Mm-hmm.
So we did a lot of changing and shipped out all that kind of stuff. That's a process that takes, you have to go between commands and all that junk, but we just taught it regardless and sent it up, and they eventually put it in. But we talked about the don't go down the same thing when you shoot, the different stuff that keeps you alive,
mm-hmm.
and started teaching that. And I remember this one class I had, which was probably the second class, which was academic class, probably 4 or 5 months after I got back.
Mm-hmm.
Was loaded with full colonels.
Hmm.
I mean, really good background credentials on these guys. And I remember they were really interested in all this leadership stuff. So I thought, boy, I got an opportunity here to tell them stories. And,
mm-hmm.
and we did and talked about stuff. And I actually spent extra hours with two or three of these guys that ended up getting promoted to general. And some of them ended up as commanders of, one of them ended up as commander of U-Bahn.
Hmm.
But really good guys, and they were going into combat, and they realized they were getting guys that were bomber pilots and what else, and they couldn't count on a lot of extra leadership coming from the pilots themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they were making big changes where the backseat pilots, a lot of them, were going to have to turn around and go back as front seat pilots. So they were going to have some experience there, but they had guys that were also brand new in the front and hadn't done any gunnery, but mm-hmm. at least they knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So those things came up, and a lot of different things. In the midst of all this, we got a new model of the F-4, which was the F-4D.
Mm-hmm.
I'd flown only the C. And it had different equipment. It had some warning gear for missiles and that sort of thing. It had electronic warnings. It had a better radar. It had a radar bombing system that we didn't have in the C. Some things that really did help, but they weren't really big changes.
Mm-hmm.
We still had bad missiles. The missiles weren't firing the way they should. We had a lot of problems with that was primarily in the radar-guided missile, the Falcon. The AIM-9. AIM-7, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
But we just plugged along in there, and it was different. We invented different places kind of in South Florida down by the Everglades, where there's nothing. And we found little points and places down there, and we'd pick out where they were, and we had an inertial navigator on the F-4, so we could pinpoint pretty close to where it was within a couple of miles.
Mm-hmm.
And we would make these guys develop a flight into that region and then pop up when they got to a certain point and then acquire the target and make attacks on it.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd divide the flights up so we'd be attacking from different headings and that kind of stuff. It turned out to really be a neat deal, and because half the time, especially all of us, were missing it at first. And then we got to where we knew what to do, and then you got to know how to look for stuff, and then you could tell people that. And it just kind of moved into a different stuff. We started doing offset bombing off little dams and things that were there. The only range we had, however, was still that old gunnery range where
mm-hmm.
you went around in a circle.
Mm-hmm.
But we tried to emphasize the point that you just can't do that.
Right.
But that was good. And then someplace in the middle there where I felt I was doing okay, I got a call and was going to the weapons school. So that was a neat deal.
Where was that?
Everybody wants to go to the weapons school. It's they only take, what is it, about 60-something pilots a year
mm-hmm.
and run them through the fighter weapons school. And you learn everything there is to learn about the weapons business, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It's out at Las Vegas, at Nellis.
Mm-hmm.
There's huge ranges out there, which means you can go and just do anything, literally, for miles and miles without anybody even knowing you're there.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to take the family out. We had to rent a little place and took the kids and all that business.
When was this, sir?
This was, 67.
Okay.
I think it was, I can't remember now, something like March of 67,
mm-hmm.
I think. And we went out there, and that was almost a four-month course, three and a half months.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent 6 days a week, 12 hours a day. And really hard, for me especially.
Mm-hmm.
The first week we got there, they started out a program and said, well, we're going to review a little bit of trig. We'll take a day and a half here. That ought to be enough. And of which I'd never taken.
Mm-hmm.
And gave us slide rules, and we didn't have calculators then.
Mm-hmm.
And just said, okay, here's some problems, and anybody needs help, wants a little extra help, come on in. And I went in, I said, I don't know any of this. And I tell you, this guy spent probably 8 hours with me. I went home, stayed up all night, used one of my Dexedrines,
mm-hmm.
and finally came in for our test, which I passed by 1 point, and I think he was kind.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, oh, my God, if this is what this school's like.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out, I mean, I could literally build with my eyes closed, tell how every event that happens in four different nuclear weapons, how you put them together, how they work, how you take them apart, how you do all this stuff. And it went on to everything from how you load weapons, how you put in the fuses, how you take them out. We did it all practically as well. And then we'd go out and drop them. And they were live weapons and different stuff that we, and a lot of them were all new. We hadn't seen the new stuff. We were using up the old Korean War junk. And we discussed a lot of different things of what was wrong with our system and had a really good air-to-air course, which we hadn't had ever. And I don't know. I just, the time I walked out of there, I was just one big massive number. But I felt so good. And I don't know. It's another one of those things that's kind of like an empowering. You've got the data that now you think maybe people will listen to you.
How long did the school last?
Almost 4 months.
Wow.
And it's a really, they just call it your master's degree in fighter pilot. But and they still have the same thing. It's changed a lot because now they brought in all these ranges up there, and they have what they call red flag, which they bring in dissimilar aircraft. You fight air to air with different airplanes. You're all, everything's tracked. You're, it's all the new modern technology now. But that was really quite new to us when we were there. So we came back, and that's when we did a lot more work as far as setting up the syllabus for the training, for the replacement training. And I went TDY a couple of times back to Southeast Asia to see some things and look at a couple of weapons we were playing with, trying to see if they'd work. And one of them was the very primary program that would be the laser-guided bomb. But we played with that a little bit. It didn't work.
You would go over just to... just kind of check out the weaponry and
see if it would work, see what kind of things in the terrain and look at different stuff, see if it would explode. We worked on, you know, this brand new bomb that they're talking about that's 20,000 pounds or whatever. It's a fuel air bomb. In other words, we call them the butane bombs. But what you do is you drop a charge that breaks up at the right time and it sprays liquid butane. And just as it's gaseous, then that you fuse it. And, you fuse it with a whole huge bunch of solid, like pellet explosive stuff. And all this has to work just perfect. And then it, of course, blows, and they're just mammoth explosions. So we tried to make these work, and it didn't work very well. But played around with some of that stuff, and I was having a ball, and we were getting along great. Everything was fun. And I got a call from the personnel people and said, you got a new assignment. And I said, but I'm not ready. It's not time yet. And they said, yes, it is. You've got an S prefix. You're a weapons officer. You're going either to Turkey or Libya.
Wow.
Which one do you want? It's like, ooh. So Turkey was all nukes. Which I wouldn't, just get one mission. And Libya was the gunnery range for Europe. And we were going to develop a tactical range down there for the people in Europe so that then we had some more training besides just running around low level. And so I put in for that, got that assignment. We all went over with a family, a guy that was my sponsor, which you always have a sponsor in the military when you move. Someone writes and says, this is what you need. Told me all this stuff because he'd been my squadron operations officer after I got back from U-Bahn. And I really trusted him. We went over there, and it was just, oh, my God. It was like U-Bahn only worse. When they vented the airplane at about 10,000 feet coming into land at Wheelis, we could smell Libya. And it was just all swell. And then there, the first night, we spent the BOQ with the kids, and at 4 o'clock in the morning, you hear donkeys braying, and the people are calling people to prayer. And I thought, oh, boy. And we lived in a 25-foot by 8-foot trailer, and with four of us. It was just miserable.
Wow. How long did you have to stay there?
Well, I was there until after Gaddafi took over the government. They had a coup while I was there, and I flew out and left my wife there with her kids, and with these Libyans running around shooting in the air.
Why did you fly out and leave your wife?
Because we had to take an airplane to safety.
Oh, okay.
So that's another one of those fun things you get with the service.
Right.
But, yeah, I left my survival pistol with Fran, though, so she had something like 12 shots.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Wow. So tell me about what was Libya like?
It was miserable. I mean, it was just poverty, poverty, poverty off the base, except for the oil people.
What city were you near?
In Tripoli.
In Tripoli, okay.
And communist influence there, a lot of unrest. The king was sick. He was dying. They knew they were going to take over. The radical Muslims were already alive and well, which we really didn't know much about then.
Mm-hmm.
But this was after the Six-Day War and whatever had happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a lot of real mad Arabs running around.
Mm-hmm.
And they ended up taking over the government. It turned out it was pretty much of a bloodless coup. They did zap a number of the king's party, but what it amounted to is they just said, you got to get out of here. Well, I didn't even get back for something like 5 weeks. And then I was back for a week, and I was back in Italy then,
mm-hmm.
running a school there at Aviano, which now has grown up. But we started training our pilots there to go to Southeast Asia.
Your job at in Libya and in Italy was as an instructor pilot?
Yeah, I was what they call a weapons officer for the wing.
Okay.
And that's an instructor flying as well as the weapons programs.
Okay.
And so in Europe, for example, the weapons officer is primarily responsible for the nuclear lines that everybody sits, briefs them, make sure everybody knows what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
all that stuff, as well as regular training. But we set up a little special school, and there were 8 of us that were weapons school graduates there doing the training.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
it was a fun school. It was just, again, I had to leave my family down there and
mm-hmm.
in a bad place. And, of course, there were very little amenities, and we lived in these trailers, and it was pretty bad living. But and before I left, though, another job I had there was I ran the missile test program.
Mm-hmm.
We had 3 of them in the world. One was in Philippines, one was at Wheelis, and the other was at Eglin in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And we shot the only in the world the test that's ever been done is low-level Sparrow shots,
mm-hmm.
our radar missiles.
Right.
And found all kinds of problems with them, and we proved what was wrong in Southeast Asia. And this time we documented it because we had all this carrier wave stuff. But that showed up later in a warehouse and never been looked at.
So they did not implement?
Never implemented any of it.
Wow.
But we finally got out of there and got up to Germany, and we thought, oh, boy, we moved up to Bitburg. And, and I thought, oh, man, we've got a couple of years up here. This is going to be wonderful. And then I I hadn't been there a month, and I got a thing from the guy saying, guess what, you're going to Karat, Thailand.
Oh, wow.
For your second tour, you're going to be the wing weapons officer there.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just at Christmas time, 69, I guess it was.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So by March, I guess it was, whatever, February, March, I guess, actually, I was in Philippines going through the snake school, which was now our jungle survival school,
mm-hmm.
and another sea survival.
Mm-hmm.
And
had it changed much from the first time you went through those schools?
Quite a bit. They did a lot of different stuff, but schools are always the same kind of thing. Academics in the morning, do practical the afternoon, or however it works, one way or the other. And it was good. We did helicopter pickups, which were really good because you never knew when you might be down in a jungle, and we used the new equipment, the jungle penetrators and all the stuff they didn't have when we were there the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And I got looking at all kinds of stuff, and then I suddenly got a surprise and said my assignment's been changed from Karat to FUCAT.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered why, and it turned out this guy that had, knew a general real well said he didn't want to go to FUCAT, he wanted to go to Karat, so they sent him there.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up in FUCAT, and which was a closed base in Vietnam. You can't go off base.
Okay.
And we had Koreans guarding us there.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the Koreans.
We didn't see them hardly ever. Since there was nothing to do, and I didn't like to hang around inside or watch movies and didn't do much reading again, I liked to wander around. So I became friendly with the military police and the guards and the army guys there and wandered around all the different units that we had posted there.
Mm-hmm.
To find out about their stuff. We could go fly with other people and do all kinds of stuff,
mm-hmm.
actually, which I did. But we would go out, for example, and you'd get to go fire a 50 caliber machine gun into a fire zone at
mm-hmm.
night and all that stuff, which mm-hmm. I got a kick out of.
So that was your entertainment, basically.
Well, that kind of stuff. If you couldn't just go to the bar all the time.
Right.
That was about all the entertainment you got, and they'd have some of these movies that came in. They were all cut up because the Special Forces guys would take out all the girly pictures. So you'd
okay.
have these strange movies.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't real fun. We had a strange outfit there. It was only two squadrons
mm-hmm.
of F-4Ds, and it was kind of a mixed bag as far as a mission. And I knew the wing commander. He moved in, and I knew him well. As a matter of fact, I had been one of the guys that had taught him academics. He was one of those guys that came over as a colonel, and he got that job.
Mm-hmm.
And he made me the wing weapons officer, although I had to be still fly as a flight commander in one of the squadrons because
mm-hmm.
we just didn't have that many people.
Right.
So they were having some problems there, and I found a bunch of junk that was wrong and typical stuff that they hadn't had a wing weapons guy to really go out or somebody trained to look for it.
What kind of problems did you find?
Oh, bombs weren't going off. They were napalm was doing funny stuff. Guys were doing bad tactics generally, and or dropping the bombs before they would arm. Things like that. They didn't know how to set the settings. It's pretty basic stuff when you've worked in that, but it's you go out and find out what the guy's doing, and you say, look, the bomb either does this or does that. A bomb's a pretty simple device, and you've got two choices, basically, when you drop a bomb. You drop it, which is actually three, but you drop it with a nose fuse or you drop it with a tail fuse.
Mm-hmm.
And where the fuse goes off blows the bomb up in that direction.
Okay.
That's pretty simple. But
mm-hmm.
if you want to blow holes in the ground, you let the tail fuse work, in other words. So if you've got suspected caves, which there were a lot of in Vietnam, these
mm-hmm.
guys would dig these holes, then you drop bombs that way. And that way it puts a lot of force into the ground and collapses a lot of these tunnels. But if you've got guys in the open or up or in trees or whatever, you want to do it the other way. So we just taught our guys to a little more of that and how to do different missions and how to look for stuff. And wing commander was real happy, and I was just saying I ought to go talk to our forward air controllers.
Mm-hmm.
He said, go ahead. And we had a squadron of them close. Some of them were flying out of FUCAT, others at Quy Nhon, and so I went and talked to those guys.
Mm-hmm.
They'd never been trained ever on weapons effects.
Really?
So, I mean, it was so fast, they'd gone out and really didn't know. So I sat down with these guys and started saying what pilots see when their fighter pilot sees, and when they tell them this or that, what that means to the pilot. So we started a little training program in Vietnam, and I went around to probably 6-7 different units, and then we checked a guy out from Saigon that picked up on the whole thing, that was running the FAC program for the whole 7th Air Force thing,
mm-hmm.
and they started doing it. But it was a fun project because once we got these facts to know who you were, they were working for, and we all had the same call sign, so they knew it was us. And they'd come in, and our guys would always ask these same questions. How far is it from, you know, did you hit the target?
Mm-hmm.
No. Which way is it? What kind of target is it? And they'd say, we think there's some caves there, and we think whatever. And then we'd say, okay, now we're going to do this. And a lot of times they used to have us come in and just drop napalm, trying to burn off the foliage so they could see under it themselves. They weren't sure what was there. So we didn't do that kind of stuff. We started working the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
And taking a little more time. Usually it's everybody's worried and get it off and drop everything in one shot and whatever. Well, they didn't shoot at you hardly at all in South Vietnam. I mean, it was kind of like a gunnery range. And we just, after we started this thing, our bomb damage assessment stuff just went straight up.
Mm-hmm.
And the facts started saying they wanted to work with us and that kind of stuff. And so, therefore, it became kind of one of these go on a traveling road show.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that for a while, and which was nice because I got a kick out of it, and I felt it was needed.
Well, this is 1970, right?
Yeah.
Now, this is amazing. You're training the facts and revamping some of the tactics and getting new information in 1970.
That we did in 65.
It's
that same thing. Why? I truly believe that we had this group of senior officers that just felt they knew the way it was supposed to be, and that's what you do.
But this is a war.
That's right.
Is not war games.
But the other response is that we can't get in and the same thing, the same rules apply there. They changed weekly or daily or whatever, the rules of engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lot of the same rules. You couldn't do this if you couldn't do that. You couldn't, if you couldn't see this, you didn't do that. So you almost, guys would go in and troll till someone shot at them. Then they'd say, okay, this looks like it's a safe one we can hit,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of dumb.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, that's not worth it. You're not worth getting killed down here by some idiot just shooting a rifle.
So you were able to implement some of this stuff.
So we did some of it.
Okay.
And we also then, since I was there and I knew some guys, they came in with a couple of new weapons for us to play.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to help test on those, and some of them were... actually, the neatest one that I think we had was nothing more than what they call CS powder.
Mm-hmm.
It's stuff that's loaded in hand grenades, and... you can throw it in, and when it explodes, it blows this powder out with the liquid,
mm-hmm.
and it makes your eyes water. It's like tear gas, and it also makes you start throwing up, and you also throw up from the back end.
Okay.
So it's a very effective thing if you can get it on somebody,
mm-hmm.
or get them to breathe it. So we did some tests with it, and the first really effective one we had, one of these where they have these little triangles built all over Vietnam where these special forces guys ran them as
mm-hmm.
like a bastion for help for the people we were trying to help.
Mm-hmm.
And the VC would come overrun them every now and then, and they'd just slaughter anybody that was inside. And we'd get a call, and it was usually at night or something bad. And we responded and carried some of this stuff this one night. And we told the guy tell his troops to put their gas masks on, that we had dumped napalm and it didn't stop them. And we had, I think, four of these things left, and we hadn't used. And he said, okay, they're on the wire here. We had guys climbing over the wire to get in their compound, and we dropped this stuff. And he couldn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
These guys were all just out there in the open, basically, and this stuff hit, and it spreads like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And they all started getting sick.
Mm-hmm.
So they ran for it. So it was really kind of fun. And it probably didn't kill anybody or many.
Mm-hmm.
And they were sicker than dogs, and they didn't know why.
Now, this would not be considered chemical warfare, would it?
No, it isn't, actually.
Okay.
So I don't know. Somebody might say it was. But
right.
It doesn't kill you.
Right.
It just makes you sick. It's kind of like pepper spray,
uh-huh.
as well as the stuff that makes you nauseous.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it doesn't kill you because every now and then some dummy would get one of these grenades and roll it in a shower or someplace.
Oh, boy.
You want to get...
That's a bad joke.
Yeah, it's not a fun one.
Mm-hmm.
But we did that. We had a thing on cluster bombs that we did, and we worked with the Vietnamese on that.
Mm-hmm.
We had a squadron of the guys that dropped the Agent Orange in 123s at Phuket, and they would go out, and they'd take six of them, and they'd go out and hit this area, and they usually had an area that was like a valley,
mm-hmm.
and they'd go up this alley, and they'd drop this stuff. And then we would come along behind them, and where they'd done this, about a week later, when the foliage is all fallen off, and we'd drop these little bomblets. And they'd lay there, and then what happens is when someone gets near them, or they shoot out these little strings,
mm-hmm.
and when someone gets near enough to pull on one of the strings, they go off. So we had these things, we'd go seed with them, and then the Koreans would go chase the VC or
mm-hmm.
or the bad guys into this valley, and they had to go kind of up the valley,
mm-hmm.
and we'd just run them over these things. So it was very successful. It wasn't real nice, but that's
right.
what happened. But
mm-hmm.
but we did that, and we basically started the night bombing program in Cambodia. And
what do you mean? You basically started it?
Our squadron was. We were the first ones that went over and started working at night in Cambodia with flares.
Okay.
And again, we had that capability, and we taught them how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But we'd go over and work with FACs, and it was primarily river traffic is what we were after. They were bringing stuff down the Mekong.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd do it at night in these sampans.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go over and interdict them and usually blow them up. But
so you were flying these missions yourself?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we got involved with a couple of spook missions in Laos,
mm-hmm.
while I was there, which on the other side of the mountain in Laos from Vietnam. We had some guys stationed there, again, part of that group, the Raven Facts.
Mm-hmm.
And they were getting hurt real bad one time, and we went over there. We actually had to aboard into Ubon and refuel. And that's the first time I'd seen Ubon since I left. And it was all paved streets, swimming pools, beautiful club, great
mm-hmm.
quarters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it looked like an American base.
Mm-hmm.
I was really amazed.
Can you go into any detail about what you did there in Laos on those missions?
We just provided support for the FACs when they were calling in strikes. It would be bad group here in this tree line, whatever, and we'd go in and bomb them or strafe them or,
mm-hmm.
or drop nape or whatever, and try to hold these guys off, and actually they ended up losing in the long run.
Right.
But they'd snuck a pretty good size, I guess, battalion or bigger of North Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
and they were a lot better than the regular guys they were used to. So.
Right.
But that happened.
Mm-hmm.
I got sent out with the Navy for almost a month. I guess it was 3 weeks or more,
mm-hmm.
where I became part of the CTF 77 staff, which was Carrier Task Force Group 77 in the Tonkin Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
So I earned my Tonkin Gulf patch.
Okay.
But I flew off of there a couple of times, and primarily this the Air Force go-between for the admiral, whoever was in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fun. It was just, I've been on as many carriers probably as most Navy pilots. But I think I was in a couple in the med when we were running the program with the Navy shooting missiles.
Mm-hmm.
I was on two of them there, and then I ended up, I think, on six different ones in Tonkin Gulf. So, some of these that are still running around,
mm-hmm.
I've been on.
Mm-hmm.
But it was different. We found out a lot about how the Navy worked versus how we worked.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of stuff that we could pass to them to help them out a little bit. They had some stuff that I took back and passed along. Again, it's one of these where you don't share a lot of stuff. It's almost as bad as later when I got in the intelligence business to realize how nobody tells anybody what the other one knows. Hmm. And just as a outset on that, I had no idea we had 29 agencies in the United States that are had full intelligence systems.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think that isn't tough trying to talk to each other.
I can imagine.
That's just what's so neat about this whole Iraqi thing.
Mm-hmm.
Is they've got these guys not only working together, they're sharing everything, they're out there living together, they're doing all the same stuff, they all got the same thing in mind, and that's a goal.
Mm-hmm.
And the military is running them all.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and that was not the case in 1970.
Certainly wasn't. Okay. And it wasn't in 70 either. We had some of the same problems. Matter of fact, we had a little inkling thing going on, and we went up, and I was one of the few guys that had flown in North Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And we did, I think, two missions where we went up there and did orbits on trying to, in case we needed to provide MGCAP for a couple of guys.
Mm-hmm.
But on some of these little special missions they were running. But
mm-hmm.
but generally, I didn't see very much fire. There was a lot of small arms stuff. You could see tracers,
mm-hmm.
Machine gun type stuff, small cannon. 23-millimeter cannon was a bad weapon. It was tough. But we didn't get a whole lot of stuff like we got in the north. So it wasn't, personally, to me, as scary.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of different things. I wish I had flown more because I like to fly, but I felt like I was doing something. So
it sounds like what you're doing is very constructive and helpful to the war effort, despite the fact that it's late in the war.
Well, it was, and I felt good about it. I know it was surprising. They were putting together some stuff, and they were looking again for F-4 qualified S-prefix, which is weapons school guys,
mm-hmm.
and said, where can you get some? And they were saying, who's done more than half a tour? And it turns out that General Olds, Robin Olds, was going to become the chief of safety in the inspector general's office.
Mm-hmm.
And he was looking for people that had early F-4 experience in Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you pop that in, and only so many names pop out. And
right.
He recognized mine, so I ended up going to Norton Air Force Base in California mm-hmm. and working in the IG safety shop.
Now, how long did you actually stay at Phuket then?
I was there till, as a matter of fact, I left there on 20 November 1970.
Oh, okay.
I was supposed to be there until the following, March.
Mm-hmm.
And they cut the tour short. And actually, the reason they did that is they actually ended up moving the F-4s out of there, back up to Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't need a weapons guy. So.
Okay. Let me ask you a couple questions about Vietnam. Did you have any more contact with Vietnamese civilians then? I know you said it was a closed base.
Actually, none except people running around the base, like a little woman that did was a cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
Or every year you'd see a whole bunch of Vietnamese when the breadfruit would come ripen.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to be there when it did, and they attack all these breadfruit trees. And you see a lot of them, and they kind of sit around and give you a thumbs up and kind of
mm-hmm.
don't say much. But mm-hmm. we really had absolutely no go-between. I met a few guys when I went down to Saigon a couple of times down there that were working in the MACV
mm-hmm.
complex, but not really.
How different was Saigon this time around?
I hated it down there. Oh. I'd been there a couple of times. I came back one time I think after U-Bahn delivering an airplane,
mm-hmm.
and it was this huge bureaucracy, and there was so much corruption going on down there. There was always somebody was doing something. They were either, they had some deal running this, or they had some deal running something else, mm-hmm. or somebody was selling washing machines, or somebody was doing, you heard all this junk that was happening,
mm-hmm.
Frankly, I think half of them were a bunch of drunks, but
You talking about the U.S. military personnel?
Well, a lot of different ones, but some. And a lot of the joint staff was there, and a lot of them, and the civilians that came in there to work didn't really do much. We had more interference even at FUCAT. We had some of these so-called news people running around every once in a while. And they'd come up, and they were a real pain in the neck.
Really?
They drove our commanders nuts. They wanted all kinds of super special treatment. They wanted all kinds of junk, and I wasn't really involved with them with my job, but I heard about it.
Right.
And I flew with the helicopter guys there. I flew with the Army on some of their missions. I flew with the guys in the old Caribous that were going out supplying these guys in these little camps. And the 123s, I even flew with those dummy dropping Agent Orange, not knowing I was putting myself at risk. But fortunately, nothing happened. But I got shot at a lot of times in those little airplanes.
Right.
But
what were your impressions of the enemy in general?
It's hard to really say anything. They were persistent guys. I think anybody with a cause can be dangerous and give them a weapon. So it's hard to say. I don't think there was a lot of real organized stuff going on that I saw in while I was there. You'd see organization of moving equipment was really a big the Vietnamese were really good at. They could move stuff, and it was incredible how much junk they would carry and get down there, and the amount of people that just carried stuff in their arms. And that kind of stuff, but I never really witnessed much. I couldn't even talk to any of the soldiers or stuff around because they were all Koreans in our base. And I did talk. I went out a couple of times to, I think it was the first, a Big Red One. It was an infantry unit. And I flew up there a couple of times with a couple of the guys. Matter of fact, I we had a bunch of stuff we'd get in our squadron all the time about the drug problems and different stuff on that, and actually these guys wanted it, so I'd give them all these handouts and all this material about what drugs do to you. But I never witnessed much. I asked questions a couple of times about did these guys worry about fragging or some of the stuff I'd heard, and they generally know they'd heard of a case or something, but I think a lot of that stuff, at least when I was there, was overblown. He said they did have a big pot problem, and guys would sit around with nothing to do, and they'd just sit there and smoke pot. But other than that, I didn't hear anything about guys on hard drugs. And supposedly down in Saigon, which, again, it was the, supposed to be the big mother of all sins, and that supposedly had harder drugs as well as acid. And every now and then some kid would get down there from the Air Force and get some acid either there or I guess later in Thailand at Bangkok or someplace and come back and have one of these bad trip things and go nuts, and they'd have to get rid of him or do something. But we didn't, our enlisted were really good. We didn't have problems like that. Our maintenance people were hardworking, dedicated. The poor guys didn't have much to do. But I was always really proud of those guys, especially the weapons people. I worked with them very closely, and they had a hard job. But
how would you judge morale in the field in 1970?
It's kind of a mixed bag. Our units, I think, was quite high. The Navy was high, and most people are on the carriers. I tell you, those guys eat like they do on cruise ships.
Really?
And when you think about it, you cramp up 5,000 guys on a boat, you better feed them good or you're going to be in trouble.
Right.
So they eat real well. They have lots to do. They're kept busy by design. They run shifts, so you're those guys working three shifts a day, eight-hour shifts, and somebody's busy. air ops are always interesting. They're always having something. They have what they call unwraps when the destroyers and the supply ships come up alongside and do all that stuff and mm-hmm. pass stuff over.
Mm-hmm.
That's really fun to watch. It's kind of like refueling.
Mm-hmm.
And they do refuel, too, but it's just a different kind of life. I think the Navy did well. Our guys were, for the most part, happy. We had some of the guys that were in some of the FAC pilots wanted to be fighter pilots, and they were mad because they couldn't, but
mm-hmm.
they were happy when they felt they were doing something good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of it was just motivation by not having very many people to help them out. They're just mm-hmm. kind of isolated and have to live by themselves. But,
right.
But from my standpoint, it wasn't what I've heard from all these guys that talk about problem in South Vietnam, because
mm-hmm.
I just didn't see that much.
Okay.
We had a few cases of guys doing stuff, but that was actually in 1965 in Thailand. I don't think we didn't have one court-martial, and as far as I know, I don't think we put one guy on report, I think, because he kept taking stuff to off stealing stuff to take off to try and catch this girl that he was after.
Okay.
But he just, you know, his biggest problem was that he was not too smart.
Mm-hmm.
But
how about race issues? Did you ever see that?
Actually, no. We had a number. We didn't have any black pilots
mm-hmm.
At U-Bahn. I think we had one black pilot in the other squadron I was in Phuket. But we had a lot of black enlisted, and we didn't have any problems that I heard of. But and that was pretty far along, I guess, when you'd say 70, when it actually get over 72, 3.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
So I think a lot of stuff was written about because people had nothing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, that probably was the biggest pain in the neck we had, was visiting dignitaries that thought they were doing some good,
mm-hmm.
and they caused more trouble than anything else.
What was your opinion of the indigenous forces of Vietnam?
You're talking to
Arvin, the Vietnamese Air Force?
I didn't really see them much. Every now and then we'd see the little A-37s
mm-hmm.
working a place. And I talked to facts about them, and they said they generally were good.
Okay.
And they'd gotten rid of the F-5s by then, I believe, or they still may have had a couple. But they primarily flew those, and they were in choppers. And we supported them with close air support
mm-hmm.
a number of times. But on the one hand, that's... you don't know that much about what's going on, and as I said, in some cases, I'm glad I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'd have been a real good infantryman.
Why do you say that?
I don't know. It just, there's a whole difference between being in your airplane. I've heard guys say that when you get into combat on the ground with people, they become like, you hate them. You just get so uptight about the things that are happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you feel quite that same way. I don't think I could say at all I had any hatred for the North Vietnamese gunners or whatever. They were doing their job trying to get us. I think maybe I felt that way on the people that, when I got back and found out what they were doing to our prisoners. But, I don't think it was that kind of a thing. It's
mm-hmm.
I think it was just me. I talked to Fran about it an awful lot when I came back from U-Bahn, and it was, she would just say, tell me how I felt, what was all those things that guys in general don't talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, she was the only one I could ever kind of really feel comfortable saying what I really felt like.
Mm-hmm.
So I shared a lot of stuff with her, and it is funny. It's a hard thing to say, but you have to disassociate yourself a certain amount about feelings. I guess you'd say that when you fly, when you do your mission. Otherwise, you'd go nuts trying to think of all the what you might do. Would you be hurting somebody when you did this? Would you kill somebody? Would it be women and children? Would it be? I mean, that has nothing to do with it. You just try and do your job. And it's a hard kind of thing to explain. But those that did it with you, you established a real bond.
Mm-hmm.
And strangely enough, nobody ever talked about it much.
Really?
But it's funny how when you'd see somebody that was in your unit from Thailand, it was just you'd go out of your way to make sure you said hello and whatever. It was you just had a pull there.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that you're bonded for life when you get into a experience when you're sharing danger.
Yes, sir. Did the Air Force ever give you guys counsel or advice on how to handle possible psychological fallout?
Mainly it was the stuff that we had gotten or had been. Actually, our first, the only training I had, and actually I passed them along, about the stuff that I'd gotten in that school, at survival school.
Okay.
But then they did have some programs at Clark when you came in. They called part of the snake school, the jungle survival school.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a week there that they skipped me because I went in and talked to them, and they said, you've got everything.
Mm-hmm.
But they talked a lot about how you behave if you become a prisoner and the kinds of things that you want to try and do and what, and kind of review it all for everybody.
Okay.
And which I thought was good, but they don't... I would guess that if you would go ask for it from a flight surgeon, they would put you on to a psychiatrist or somebody.
Mm-hmm.
We had one guy that kind of disappeared that was really irrational as far as... and I don't know why. He was a backseat pilot, but when we got there, he just became kind of irrational. He tried to carry a 3-foot machete with him.
In the plane.
Okay. And different stuff, and it got to where he was almost paranoid at trying to carry weapons, and he was trying to find grenades and everything in case something happened that he'd be prepared. And they finally just said, hey, I don't think he's going to be able to handle this. So.
Mm-hmm.
But I never really ran into him after that. They probably just got him out.
How did you handle the thought of possibly being shot down and being taken prisoner?
Oh, actually, once I'd gone through that school and some of the rest of it, I thought, well, I have training. I know what I'm supposed to do. If it happens, it happens. I don't want to think about it. I got way more important stuff to consider.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And especially in a fighter, when you've got not only your backseater to take care of, but you got six other guys to take care of.
Mm-hmm.
You can't overtax them. You can't. You got to always fly up to the limitations of who you're flying with, and you got to think about that, and don't commit somebody to something they can't handle. And the older and the more experienced you get, the more of that you start worrying about.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, like I'd said before, on when you were really scared, this stuff came out at night when it was, for some reason, like quiet, and you're laying there in bed.
Right.
And you think, I can remember missions today, the ones I screwed up on and the things I did good.
Mm-hmm.
And my God, that's 1,000 years ago. But some of that stuff just imprints.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said before, you look for mistakes when you fly. When you every time you take off in a fighter, you're betting your life in a way.
Right.
And especially the older airplanes. The newer ones are much more reliable, but you still are doing that. So it's you can have an engine fire. You can have something else. So somebody throws a bolt in the front. You don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And all that stuff happens in seconds, and you've got to be able to react. So you're always pretty tense and try and make sure you're not you don't get complacent.
Mm-hmm.
So most guys that I knew anyway, when they got in the cockpit, they became a lot different. I mean, you could walk out and be shaken,
mm-hmm.
and get in the airplane, and you're just totally. I had a backseater I flew with at Phuket that did that,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, he really, when getting briefings, and he kind of almost like he had Parkinson.
Wow.
And then we'd get up to go out, and he just solid as a rock, and was good.
Right.
But it was just his method of coping, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody had little things that I always felt better if Fran was around because I could talk to her. But it,
mm-hmm.
it is kind of funny. You got really good buddies and other people that fly that know how you feel, but you don't talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
It, at least I didn't. I don't know many people that did.
Is that basically what you said earlier? Kind of more of a bravado. You kept it to yourself.
Yeah, it is. If anything, you get loud and noisy and sing songs or go to the bar and have a big...
Mm-hmm.
We even used to go in the bar on these really bad missions when I was at U-Bahn.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd walk in, our bartender's name, he was a little Thai guy, and his name was Buffalo, whatever reason. And,
mm-hmm.
and you'd walk in and you'd put your hand on the counter flat and make a noise, and you'd say, Buffalo, gin. And he'd look around at you, get a big smile, and he'd walk over with a old-fashioned glass and just plunk a full bottle of gin in front of you. And you sit there like John Wayne and pour a big swig, you know, mm-hmm. and look at it, not say a word, take a big swig and try not to wince too bad,
mm-hmm.
and sit back, and the other guys would all kind of do that, and then we'd all talk.
Right.
But it was some of the nutty things you do, but,
mm-hmm.
but I guess that's all part of coping, too.
Yeah, it's your way to deal with it.
Yeah.
When you look back at your experience in Thailand and flying over to Laos and North and South Vietnam, and then again when you were at Phuket, what would you say was the bravest action that you witnessed during that time? What comes to mind?
Right off the bat, I think of that guy, that rescue guy.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, when I think about it, I was on the rest cap for Robbie Risner when he got picked up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, again, another case where two 23-millimeter guys were shooting out of towns, and we couldn't attack them.
Mm-hmm.
And the helicopter was trying to get in there, and they shot one down. They actually, the second one came in, picked up the helicopter crew, and they still couldn't get Risner.
Hmm.
And I think rescues are probably it. We even had a guy that was shot down over the Gulf off of this one mission in North Vietnam, and he was out in the water, and they started shelling him
mm-hmm.
From coastal batteries. He wasn't very far offshore. And this HU-16, this old Albatross, the twin-engine little Grumman
mm-hmm.
Seaplane, came roaring in and sat down and sat there with these big spouts going up in the water that were probably 25 feet tall from these shells going off.
Mm-hmm.
And he just taxied over to these guys and picked them up, pulled them in, turned around, took off.
Wow.
So it's different stuff like that. We didn't have any, I don't know. I mean, just guys were, sometimes I watched a flight of 105s go into a really tough target right off of Hanoi when I was trying to mid cap.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so bad. I mean, it was just like, don't go in there, forget it. And these guys rolled in and went in there, and two of them got shot down.
Hmm.
And you just knew it was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing other guys just do that kind of stuff sometimes is pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I've seen rescues, I guess, are the most important. I've seen a couple of fat guys that were taking real heavy fire in South Vietnam that just kept doing it until they got guys got results.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those poor guys are flying around a little puddle jumper.
Right, right.
You know, right off the ground. So they could get hit by anything. But,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. A lot of it is you kind of conjure up what you think is going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, we find out that's usually dangerous, so you just don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But you try and just play only what you know and attack what you know. So that's better. But I've seen guys do some good stuff. But it was kind of expected. I don't think anything was ever felt that it was something extraordinary other than when someone to try and save somebody. And we, that, of course, I do think is extraordinary. But
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
those guys really were amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And that little guy in particular.
Right.
That I saw. But I guess that's the main thing.
Okay. When you look back at your service in your mind's eye, what do you see?
Oh.
Your service in Southeast Asia, I should say.
Oh, I think I see. I try and look at, I think, to start with, try and look at the good things.
Okay.
And then usually somewhere in there I get a rush about how unfair it was for my wife.
Mm-hmm.
That she's sitting back there with all these Jane Fondas and all the rest of them doing all this stuff and trying to keep her mouth shut and not knowing. It was so bad when we were there originally. The press knew that there were Air Force flying in North Vietnam, and there were F-105 Air Force flying in Vietnam, or in Thailand, actually, they'd say Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
We were the only squadron there.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the morning, she'd get up, turn on the news, the standard 7 o'clock stuff, getting the kids ready, and they'd say an F-4 was shot down in North Vietnam today,
mm-hmm.
Air Force F-4.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that narrowed the odds real quick
mm-hmm.
to about 18 airplanes. And then they'd say how many, you know, who's flying.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd have to sit around all day long until about 5 in the afternoon when they finally got the word all the way back and passed along to our chaplain. And then they'd come out and knock on the door.
Right.
So Fran had worked a deal with two or three different people, but our next-door neighbor in particular, who said he would, any time that that came up, he would check and see who it is, and if it was me, she'd come tell her.
Okay. That had to be difficult for her.
Yeah. It really, I don't know, it's just an awful lot to ask, I think,
mm-hmm.
sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't us that, I think you worried more about your family than you did your own welfare.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not fun. I'm not saying I would want to go back in the service and go to war. It doesn't mean I wouldn't.
Right.
And I think if I could or I was qualified, I'd probably go tomorrow
mm-hmm.
to help if I thought I could do something.
Mm-hmm.
But I think everybody would.
What were your opinions and what are your opinions on the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War?
Oh, I was sickened in a way as... As a matter of fact, is some of the people that did it, too. I mean, Jane Fonda was bad enough.
Mm-hmm.
There were people that I even knew their names at that time. My wife ran a Viva office where they had the Viva bracelets.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with those, but
mm-hmm.
She ran an office in Southern California with those and just worked tirelessly at that stuff. And that was in the 70s. And when we first moved there to Norton, these things had come up all the time, and I think I am an Episcopalian. I was probably a pretty good Episcopalian until I got back from the second tour.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a priest tell me that I was a killer.
Really?
Really made me mad.
An Episcopal priest.
Yeah. And it wasn't just that, but the guy, just like now in this war, the guy running the National Council of Churches
mm-hmm.
is saying that we got a bunch of trained killers over there killing Iraqis. Or, and that does get your attention. But I didn't have, other than a couple of those cases, I didn't have any real problems. We didn't have, actually, when I when I went to be an attaché, I went for an interview, Fran and I both went for an interview in at the Pentagon, and we just crossed the Key Bridge and we're coming in and entering into the main entrance of the Pentagon, and there were a bunch of idiots out there throwing animal blood on people.
What year was this?
And that was, gee whiz, wait, 80-something.
Really?
And I don't remember now what they were mad at. But you see that kind of stuff, and I've seen a lot of it, and it it's not, it just makes, kind of sickens you. I don't know what drives, I just feel that people aren't very intelligent, because they haven't looked at the whole system. But I don't know. It. I felt that we were betrayed in a way because of our leadership, political leadership primarily, and actually even our military leadership at the top was just not up to speed with what we were doing in the new requirements.
Okay.
And I always thought, in summary cases, God help us, we didn't go to war in Europe. Because there's no doubt we'd have had to use nuclear weapons, but if we ever got into a conventional war there, it would have been a horrible mess. And
why do you say that? Because of the leadership problem?
Because of the leadership right at that time. And I didn't have that opinion until afterward.
Okay.
But it kind of frightened me to think that we better get some people. And then I was really happy to see a whole bunch of guys get promoted to general that I knew well, that I knew were good people, that I knew understood. And Chuck Horner was the three-star that ran the air war in Desert Strike, Desert Storm. And he just said, I'm not going to kill people to bomb a crossroads. Drop your bombs from this altitude. When we get one that counts, I'll put you down low. And that's the only time I'm going to accept it, you coming back with holes in your airplane saying I went down to 500 feet or something. So there's times you risk and times you don't, but it's nice to have somebody tell you that. So, and from talking to F-16 guys that are flying over here out of a reserve unit at Fort Worth, that's basically how they're handling all this now. They know what works and what doesn't work and when to take a chance and when not to. And he said, and this one guy I was talking to, the colonel over there, that's one of the director of operations, was saying the same kind of thing, that you always have zealots, you have guys that don't listen, you have some people make mistakes, but he said there still are mistakes. And generally, it's that same old attitude that I had. When someone screws up, then they look at it and they say, well, what altitude was he with? Why was he risking his life down there? If that were me, I wouldn't have done that.
Right.
So that's how you cope. But I think it also ought to be part of leadership. So I think the way things are being handled now, the military's fighting the war generally. And that's what they should. And it's too bad, I think, if we had military there. I'm not sure whether it would have been a huge outcome. I'm not sure. I don't personally think the Russians would have come in with this domino theory thing. But if it were me, I would have bombed the ships in Hanoi Harbor and said, you aren't getting any supplies, and also just interdicted totally the railroads in from China. And then you just say, okay, guys, you're cut off. But that's not the way it was being done from Washington then. And every 6 weeks or so, it seemed like somebody was trying to do something different.
Right.
So... no consistency, worried about, and whether the peaceniks protesters were actually causing people to do stuff, I don't know. But I just think the administration under LBJ was very flawed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sir, what did you think in April 1975 when South Vietnam fell? What were your feelings?
Oh, I just was glad to see it was over with. Mm-hmm. I think it had been prolonged for so long, and I felt that at least most of us had moved ahead,
mm-hmm.
that we knew that it had to get over with. Someone had to just pull us out and get it done, and finally it happened.
Okay.
So as far as the political side of the settlement and that, I guess I liked some stuff, I didn't like some stuff, the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
Militarily, I think it was it hurt the service in a way, all services. But as a result of that war, I think really, trying to put it in perspective, but I think in a way it forced our younger officers as they were promoted and moved up,
mm-hmm.
to realize and start thinking that we need to start operating in a different mode, that the services really can't just argue over money, argue over funding and how many ships do I get or how many planes do I get,
mm-hmm.
how many wings, how many whatever. There's somewhere along that line it started changing to how do we fight?
Mm-hmm.
How do we accomplish the mission? Not what do we get, what's best for us, what we need to do, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it probably took the politicians along the same line. I want to build more ships. I want to build airplanes in my factory. I want to do whatever. So stuff kind of started showing up at the end of the war that nobody wanted, but it gradually the leadership started to look at joint commands.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually didn't happen till the late 70s or early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
We started looking at what kind of aircraft we needed that can do a mission that we really needed to be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
Just smaller things, but that's when the F-16 was developed, that's when the F-15 was developed. All that stuff came out of in the early 70s. All that development happened then. Lots of new missiles, lots of new different things started coming out as the result of the thinking and the people that were in a position now to say this needs improvement.
Mm-hmm.
And we also, I was fortunate enough in one of the jobs when I was in the IG to work on a project that actually got us the Nellis Gunnery Complex and what they call Red Flag,
mm-hmm.
which they say 10 flights at Red Flag is the same as 6 months of combat.
Wow.
To get you tuned into the thinking of what you might face,
mm-hmm.
and in the modern war. The overseas command started looking at different stuff. This is when guys that I knew as captains and majors started making general officer.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys, a number of them actually, Bill Kirk, who was a guy I worked with on the Red Flag project, was a colonel when I worked for him.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up making 4 stars, was USAFE commander. Heck of a guy.
Mm-hmm.
And very thoughtful people. Most of these guys were had master's degrees. They weren't just guys sitting around. A lot of them were aeronautical engineers. A lot mm-hmm. of them very well trained. A lot of academy graduates. It just took a long time to develop because you got to break down that thinking
mm-hmm.
that was going on by the folks in our own services as well as the folks, our politicians.
But it did happen, you're saying.
But it happened. At mm-hmm. least I feel like it's almost happened today.
Mm-hmm.
We don't get too many things rammed down our throat anymore. There's always exceptions. But the military doesn't just have to accept an airplane or a thing because the guy from Washington State wants Boeing. Or they're starting to look at, can it do this mission? And as bad as it is, and you see how long it takes to try and develop an F-22, this is held up by political things. It isn't held up by the service.
Mm-hmm.
They want their piece of the action or the piece of the pie. And it isn't the service that wants the changes. It's
mm-hmm.
the guys involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
So we're a democracy, and that's how we work, and we put up with it. But fortunately now, there was a change from where, and I saw these things. We would bring guys in the ground training environment when we were working the ranges at Nellis.
Mm-hmm.
Helicopters started getting moved into the force structure. When I got out of the flying business and got in the intelligence business, I found out the Navy SEALs and the special Delta Force guys and,
mm-hmm.
and our Green Berets and all these guys started working together. And they started working not just attack or whatever, but it was a total concept of what's been happening today.
Mm-hmm.
And it's marvelous to see that guys go in, they've got medics, they've got rescue people, they've got all kinds of equipment, different things that it's just unimaginable.
Mm-hmm.
And those kinds of things, I really wonder if we had years back what combat would have been like.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still dangerous. Guys still get killed. Guys still make mistakes. But it's getting where it's a lot better than
mm-hmm.
it was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who'd have thought you could have a war in 1 month and kill a couple of hundred people?
I know.
I mean, it's just unbelievable. But I think the progression has been just enormous since I was in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the public really understood those changes. It never was sold to them. The military doesn't go out and sell themselves too much except within their own academy structure
mm-hmm.
or in the schools, the military schools.
Mm-hmm.
But you rarely get to see what the differences are. But until when I first heard that they were going to put embedded media people with combat units,
mm-hmm.
I just cringed. And now I'd say, thank gosh that these guys are there, because now that whole conspiracy theory stuff goes out the window.
Right.
And but I think we've learned some huge lessons, and there's still this politicians can still misrupt the military and misuse them.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen some of that recently. Somalia was one, some other stuff that was, I think, a very big misuse of what our capabilities should be. But
mm-hmm.
but if we're going to use power, we need to use it successfully and use the equipment we have at our disposal the best way we can.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly didn't do that in Southeast Asia in the 60s and 70s. We certainly didn't do it in Korea. We look at the numbers of people that died in World War II when thousands and thousands of guys just storm a beach being shot at.
Mm-hmm.
It's just sheer numbers how many survived just by sheer luck not getting hit.
Mm-hmm.
Now we don't do that. And I think that's marvelous. I really do. I think the thing that I've seen, and that's, as I mentioned before, just being over here talking to some F-16 guys and the follow-on people, I don't really think that our people have changed that much.
Mm-hmm.
They're still caring. They're still wisecracking. They're still doing the same stuff. They still have the... I had to laugh at this one general officer I ran into. He said, the only difference in the squadron today, and it was when your day, is he said, when you go into the John and look at the magazine in the back of the door,
mm-hmm.
he said, then you had Playboy and whatever. He said, now you have PC magazine, you know, computer
mm-hmm.
science, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, other than that, and that everybody runs now, nobody smokes, they watch their booze, a lot of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They take better care of themselves. But he said the eagerness, the camaraderie, all that's still there.
Mm-hmm.
And even the group I belong to called the Red River Valley Fighter Pilots Association.
Okay.
That was guys that had to fly over downtown Hanoi.
Right.
And to be a member.
Mm-hmm.
So we finally were all dying off, so they decided they'd let the guys in from Desert Strike.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to one of the reunions we had back at the 75th anniversary of the Air Force. They had it in Las Vegas and ran into all these old guys and whatever, and then there's all these new guys.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, it's surprising. I think they would have fit in at U-Bahn and probably done just as much or get in more trouble than we did. But it's a funny group. I think Americans are really unique.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question about today's Americans and the Vietnam War. What would you tell young people today about the Vietnam War?
Basically what I've told you guys. I think we've progressed. They've moved to where now there's so much more thought and the rest of it. But the ideals haven't changed.
Mm-hmm. It's become more efficient and better.
Oh, much.
Uh-huh.
But the idea that, I mean, these kids today, when you see these interviews that's going on in Iraq, they have that same, I'm over here because I think we can make it better.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only reason that, at least in my 33 years in the service, that I understood. It was, you did things to make things better.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't that you go to kill people. It's not even that, that isn't even the kind of thing you're thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, it isn't just military training, because I was an ROTC guy, history major. I was right alongside of West Point guys that before the Air Force Academy even came about,
mm-hmm.
People that had gone to Citadel and whatever that were really military trained. And heck, when we finally got into flying airplanes, we didn't have any different feelings for what we were doing it for.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not some love of attack, killing, whatever.
Right.
And it isn't for the idea that the uniform looks good or whatever. You certainly don't do it for the money.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just those kinds of things that go along. And even today, we're so far behind, because I just heard on the news on one of our breaks, if a young Army guy, private, or a Marine guy gets killed today, his family gets $6,000. That's his insurance.
Wow.
And when, as a pilot, they get more now, and I don't know what it is, but when I was in, it was $10,000 for a pilot. So the country still hasn't, I think, paid the guys what they should be getting, but it that's sure not why they're in.
Mm-hmm.
That there's lots more reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it is family history. Some of it is past things they've seen. Most of us that I've run across, and even a lot of us before, either had an interest in other countries or had a pretty good feeling or had visited lots of places. And when you go to Thailand or someplace and see the absolute poverty and how bad it is, and think how different it is in our country.
Mm-hmm.
You see real quick that what these poor people are suffering and going through, you'd like to make it better.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's probably some of it. I have no doubts that the military has moved in the right direction. I'm so proud to see that these guys can do what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Gee whiz, these carrier guys today are flying 7 or 8 hour missions routinely.
Mm-hmm.
I flew probably 5 of those or 6 in a combat tour.
Wow.
And those are taxing. your body doesn't, you're in a pressurized setup where your body doesn't, gets rid of moisture real quick.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't carry enough water to be safe.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a really tough, difficult thing that a lot of these guys are doing now. But you sure don't hear a lot of them complaining.
That's right.
So I think we've learned a lot of lessons. I'm not sure if the general public has been taught very much. It certainly isn't taught in schools very well,
mm-hmm.
at least in the public schools.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of history isn't taught well. A lot about cultures isn't taught very well. And
mm-hmm.
I think we're making huge mistakes in our education system by not getting more involved. I saw how important that was when I was in Yuban and talked with Buddhist monks
mm-hmm.
about how they lived, and at least I knew a little bit about it and could ask them questions, and when I asked questions, I could see the light in their eyes and that I wanted to know.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't some heathen that came in just to pillage their country.
Right.
So I think those things are taught at our academies.
Mm-hmm.
So we teach a lot of people, but we don't do that in our computer skills. And the guy that becomes a programmer these days
mm-hmm.
has nothing in humanities. And there's a lot to learn about when you talk about Iraq and these countries. If you know what happened 2,000 years ago,
mm-hmm.
it's a little different to see how they progress and why some of the cultures are that way. So I just am proud as punch of these guys these days because most of them are very, very well educated. I don't know what the real facts are, but I can guarantee you that a huge percentage of our Air Force officers and probably Army and Navy officers as well have master's degrees, some of them doctorates, well-educated. They've been all kinds of places. They've done stuff. They've, as part of your training when you're overseas, you get involved in having to go places.
Mm-hmm.
In Germany, for example, our young airmen and stuff were encouraged and taken for nothing to go see Birkenwald and Dachau
mm-hmm.
and some of the places to see what that meant. And it's important to do that. And I think we do that in the service, which unfortunately we don't do other places.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a real sobering thing to see a death chamber.
Yes, sir.
And that's just, I think that becomes part of the motivation of national service.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure a lot of people aren't cut out to do that. They don't have the interest to get them there.
Mm-hmm.
I just have always had a great interest in people and what makes them tick and
mm-hmm.
and why they believe that way. And I talked with the people in Libya, guys that could speak some English, had even translators talking about stuff, asking them why they did this, why they did different things. I feel that I know an awful lot more than my neighbor
mm-hmm.
about what drives people in the Islamic world. I think I know a lot about the Far East. I think I know a lot about the Europe and other parts in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's just certain people that want to do those things, like you want to be a professor,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is a wonderful, noble profession, which I even considered once.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a little too much academics and running around flying fighters
mm-hmm.
for me.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always that draw that I think that's kind of like athletics. It's I don't know if you ever drove a Porsche or something like that, but
mm-hmm.
When you strap yourself into a F4 or an F86 or something like that and step down on the pedal, it's about 500 times better than that Ferrari. and you can do it in three dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
So from you have the feeling that you own the sky up to 50,000 feet and can do, if you're good at it, you can do anything you want.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been an interesting life, for me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I hope others choose a profession. I hope others can learn from what I think we in the military have done.
Mm-hmm.
I think Vietnam was another lesson. I think if you go back and look at, if you do become a student of history and military, you can go back to to Clausewitz, you can go back to the First World War, you can go back to what drove Eddie Rickenbacker into doing stuff, you can
mm-hmm.
say what drove Richard Bong into being a great fighter pilot in the Second
mm-hmm.
War, what could be so-and-so, how these guys were motivated and why they did the things they did. But it's always evolved. And it seems like these wars, every time we have one, we evolve into a new regime. I think we've evolved now into a much different one.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh knows what it's going to go from here.
Mm-hmm.
It appears to be unmanned, which I think would be awfully difficult for me to sit in a trailer somewhere and fly an unmanned fighter
mm-hmm.
out and attack something. It just
mm-hmm.
doesn't seem like the same deal.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question. Have you been to the Wall in Washington?
Oh, yeah.
What was your experience like there?
Oh, I looked up primarily everybody I knew that was on it, which we knew quite a few people, and also even through the Viva project that Fran worked on, we had lots of people we knew that we almost felt we knew their families. When I was in that same time period, I was flying the little T-39s around, executive jets,
mm-hmm.
and we flew military wives that were husbands were missing in action, and
mm-hmm.
they got free rides all the time by any of us that wanted a ride. We just put them on the airplane,
mm-hmm.
and we had permission to do it. So we flew a lot of people around, and talking to these women that their guys were missing, they put in a lot because the services in those days didn't help them much. I don't know that much about it now, but
mm-hmm.
I hope it's better than it was then. If a pilot in our squadron was shot down and he had nothing extra, his wife got $10,000 worth of insurance and his pay stopped the day he got shot down.
Mm.
So if he's sitting there with two kids at home, he didn't get much. Well, they've evolved a lot since then too.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still, by declaring somebody missing, it's a godsend to the family in a way, because at least gives them a little shot for a while to get their act together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that insurance money doesn't go very far. So the guys today are better off. But it's even like the recent shuttle failure.
Mm-hmm.
The military guys, I think, now get something like $75,000.
Mm-hmm.
And the civilians get $700,000.
Mm-hmm.
So it hasn't equaled itself, but it's still I think it's still a great job.
Would you ever want to go back to Vietnam, Southeast Asia?
No, actually, I have no desire whatsoever.
Why is that?
I don't know. I went back to Thailand, not as civilian. I went back later, just going through,
mm-hmm.
and it had modernized. It had changed. It had. It just wasn't the same as I had seen it, and it. I thought I would have different feelings when I went there, and I didn't. It just kind of like my feelings were with the people that were there. It was interesting to see a lot of the same sights,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't. I didn't go there to take over Thailand or whatever, and it just didn't, it just wasn't the idea that there was anything, it was the people I was with that were important.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could go to Las Vegas or the house down the street and reminisce more or feel more actual feelings about the war at someone's house than I would by going back to the sea.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that some of the guys that were on the ground say that that's a great help for them, but it it wasn't for me to go to Thailand, and I don't think it would make much difference.
Okay.
But
all right. Well, sir, is there anything else that you'd like to add to our conversation today?
Oh, I don't think so. It, I've rambled on for a long time, but it. I hope if somebody else is able to use this, they they will use it in good faith and hopefully take some time to understand the new guy on the block and see what he's doing. There's always a private story there, not the political story.
Right. Okay, well, this will end the interview with Richard Hamilton. Thank you very much, sir.
Mm-hmm.